Hi, I'm Julie Almacher. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, the extended podcast version of my conversation with composer Howard Shore. You'll find out more about his two concerti, Ruin and Memory and Mythic Gardens, and also how his love of gardening inspired the music that he wrote for Lord of the Rings, not to mention his early days with Saturday Night Live. It's all just ahead. Enjoy. Well, when most of us think of Howard Shore these days, we think of film composer, but your career has just been so varied. Would you just remind us of the path that got you where you are today?
Oh, that's quite an involved question because I have to go back to studying the clarinet when I was 10. I studied with a very good teacher who taught me counterpoint and harmony, and I started composing quite early on. And then I just followed a lot of different parts of the music world. I was educated at Berklee School of Music in Boston. I studied with John Bavicki, great choral composer. And it kind of led me to writing for small groups, jazz groups. And I was on the road for 4 years with the rock group Lighthouse. I did about 1,000 one-nighters and 8 albums and went from there to CBC in Toronto, where I wrote for radio dramas and comedies, and then went into television, into variety, worked with Lorne Michaels when I was very young, and we met up again in New York with a bunch of writers and performers, and started a show called Saturday Night Live in 1975, the show premiered. In the late 78, 79, I started working with the director David Cronenberg, and over the course of the last 30 years, did 15 of his films and recorded and composed music for 80 films.
Okay, well, you did a pretty good job of giving us an elevator speech in about a minute and a half.
Yeah, I gave you a whole career's worth, you know, in a very short time. Now I'm writing a lot of concert music. I'm doing a lot of commissions now. I wrote an opera and piano concerto, which I think we're going to talk about, and a cello concerto, and also finished a guitar concerto recently, working on a new song cycle. So the music continues.
And now I know the soloists are usually key for you. Who is going to be the soloist in this guitar concerto?
Miloš.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the great Montenegrin guitarist.
Well, because he actually had an injury recently, so he must be recovering pretty well, huh?
Indeed, yes, he is. He's recovering, and we actually missed our premiere, which was February of this year. The piece is finished, and he has it, so we're hoping for next year. As soon as he's ready, we'll do the premiere.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more, just a little bit, about your relationship and friendship with Lorne Michaels, because you guys were childhood friends, right?
Yes, we actually met at a summer camp in Northern Ontario, and we started doing shows at camp, you know, musicals, and we did the Fantastics and shows like Bye Bye Birdie and West Side Story, you know, what you do in summer theater, you know, as kids. And then we continued our friendship and we worked at CBC Radio and CBC Television. And then we continued in New York at NBC with Saturday Night Live. So we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, and he basically took you to New York with him to launch Saturday Night Live. You were doing everything that was music-related with that show. I mean, you're kind of downplaying it, but, you know, I mean, you wrote pieces that they're still using, like some of the pieces you wrote as, like, intros and things?
Well, the themes I wrote, the opening and closing theme. Yeah, I mean, it was a much smaller production. It was late night. It was Saturday broadcast. And Saturday, those evenings were just all reruns. And there wasn't a lot of people watching television. So we weren't really closely monitored. And it was a very small group, maybe 12, 15 people. I did a little of everything. At the time, I did a bit of acting. I did a lot of writing, arranging, and you know, just about everything that was required.
Now, Lauren made an interesting observation about you. He said that you were never in a hurry. Even when it came to just putting an album on the turntable, you would clean it with care. I'm wondering, would you say that you take that similar approach with your composing?
There was a bit of Ed Norton aspect to it. That's what he's referring to. You know, the honeymooners where, you know, Norton would take his time doing these things. And of course, Crampton would get very upset with him because he wasn't doing things fast enough. There was a bit of that, you know, it was a bit of comedy, really.
Well, I also want to just backtrack slightly because you mentioned that you studied with a great choral composer or someone who was well known in the choral field. And tell me a little bit more about what you learned from that teacher who was known for choral composing.
Yes, I mentioned him earlier on and that it was John Bevieke, who is a great choral composer. I studied with him in Boston when I was at the Berklee School of Music. And I think he started me into the idea of working with voices. And Lord of the Rings is essentially a choral piece for symphony orchestra and chorus. And lots of soloists as well. So the voice was really an important part of Lord of the Rings. I was trying to create a piece that was historical, had a sense of antiquity, and what better way to express those ideas than to start with the human voice?
As I was reading more about the influences of these two concertos that are on your new recording, you mentioned being Canadian and how your exposure to nature really influenced your Lord of the Rings music, as well as this cello concerto in particular. Would you expand on that a little bit, please?
Yes. The piano concerto came first, a Rune in Memory, and it was a commission for the 200th anniversary of Chopin. And it was premiered in Beijing by Long Yu and the China Philharmonic. And it was written specifically for Long Long, who premiered it and did the recording. And then I wanted to write another piece, really a companion piece for it. And I had a commission from Sophie Chow, New York cellist, great musician. And she commissioned the cello concerto. And I wanted to write a piece that also reflected the piano concerto, which I had just finished. And I wrote it in a similar language to the Chopin piece, essentially a 19th century language and a neoclassical work, if you will.
Tell me a little bit about how you met Sophie, the cellist that's featured on this recording, and why you decided she was the right person to write a concerto for.
Right. I did the score to a documentary called Miracoon, The Betrayal, directed by Ellen Kuras. And she spent 25 years creating the piece. She's a wonderful cinematographer and has shot many films. And she felt very strongly about this piece. It's about a family from Laos that survived the war, the Vietnam era, and came to America. And it was actually nominated for an Oscar a few years ago. And I wrote chamber music pieces for it. And I wrote pieces for solo cello as well, and cello duets. And I used Sophie to record the cello music. And I met her in New York on that project. And then she wanted to continue working with me, and she found the commission for the cello concerto. It was commissioned, premiered by the American Symphony Orchestra, Leon Botstein conducting.
And one of the things that makes this performance even more unique is the fact that she's performing on an instrument that was once owned by Pablo Casals. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, it's a very beautiful cello that she has. Yes, so many of these great artists have wonderful instruments. This one has a great pedigree to it.
Final question about mythic gardens. It's inspired by three gardens, three Italian gardens, or maybe the architecture around those gardens. Would you share that story, please?
These are three gardens that I visited. They're Italian gardens, and I love to write about nature. I discovered, actually, by working with a lot of Tolkien's work, obviously from Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And Lord of the Rings is a war story, but it's essentially a story about nature, about everything green and good, the love of nature, and the preservation of everything that we love. And I found it was part of what went into Lord of the Rings. And so connecting to that with the cello concerto, I wanted to also create another work based on nature, and it felt very natural for me to write to the beauty of these Italian gardens.
I want to talk a little bit about what I guess I would describe as your modesty. It comes through a comment that I read, something that David Cronenberg, one of your Canadian colleagues, said about you. And he said that your Canadianness is very much a part of what makes you who you are as a composer. To not impose yourself in an aggressive way, but being allowed to kind of, you sort of compromise, and you really work to understand other people's point of view and maybe just how all the elements work together. And I felt like I was really hearing that in the piano concerto, Ruin and Memory, especially through the orchestrations, how they just framed so gently the piano soloist.
You know, I was very much wanted to show the piano in its beauty and not write for the orchestra in a way to obscure the piano. And I like to watch the performer. I like to really write for the movement, the breathing of the performer. And so I'm really conscious of, you know, working around the edges. So even in film, you know, quite often I would write scores that worked around the corners of the frame, worked around the edges, and supported the narrative. In the same way I'm doing that with Long Long, I'm putting him in the spotlight and just putting the beauty of the orchestra around him. So every movement to the piano is supported and beautiful.
I was just thinking about when Long Long started his career, he was often criticized for being a little too flashy, too showy. And then he put out a Chopin recording, and the critics were like, oh, well, now we can see, you know, what he really can do, right? And so it's just interesting that you're reflecting the life of Chopin through this work. Can you tell us a little bit more specifically how that comes through in each movement?
I like to do a lot of research before I write, and I do a lot of listening, a lot of reading, a lot of studying, and then I simply put all the material away, and then I question myself, what do I have to say about this? What's a true feeling from my heart? You know, where does the truth lie? And so in terms of the Chopin piece, I'm creating a piece, you know, an emotional piece of mine to him and to Long Long, and trying to create a piece that expresses the ideas of the period that Chopin lived in. Hence the title, Ruin and Memory. You know, it's a memory, really, of the world that he lived in, and of course the destruction that he experienced at the later part of his life.
By destruction, do you mean his own personal life?
Yes.
Because I was actually going to ask you about the title and how that reflected that.
Yeah.
Now, this work was premiered in 2010. Is that the performance that we're hearing, the original premiere?
Yes, the original recording of the premiere, yes.
Were you there for that?
I was indeed, yes.
What do you remember most about that?
I remember being with Long Long in Beijing is very magical. He's so popular and he's so well known that being with him and doing things with him was really amazing. And I remember the premiere as being rather star-studded because it was part of the Beijing Music Festival that was going on at the time. So there was quite a celebrity audience. I remember Penderecki was in the audience, and you know, it had great musical. It was just a great musical night.
I know there are hints of Debussy and Satie sprinkled inside this concerto. Where does that come through?
You know, I lived in France for a while. You hear so much music in Paris that you don't really hear in other parts of Europe. You hear a lot of, French recordings, and I think maybe that influenced me.
And I think if I'm remembering correctly, Chopin spent some time in Paris as well.
Of course.
So I guess that makes sense that you would be inspired by that. One of the things that struck me is how I think I read that you lived off of Saturday Night Live royalties for about a decade before you really dove into film composing. Is that right?
No, that is entirely accurate. What I did was I transitioned. I started writing for film on the third year of Saturday Night Live. So I would do recordings in the summer, which is always traditionally the hiatus in television. And so 78, 79, 80, I would be recording. And then, yes, there was many years because I was doing these small films. They weren't supportive, really, you know, in terms of how you could live. And so the television really allowed me to do films for years. Yeah, about 8 or 10 years. It wasn't until maybe the late 80s that I started doing films like Big and in Hollywood and After Hours with Martin Scorsese and The Fly with Cronenberg. And then I just kept writing all through the 90s.
The Lord of the Rings trilogy, of course, was a huge turning point for you. And then after that, did you put your pencil down for a while?
Well, it took 4 years to write the trilogy. The score is about 12 hours. And it was a pretty intense period. And I think I put the pencil down for the year 2004. I didn't do a lot of composing. I was mostly conducting that year. And then in the year after, 2005, the pencil came back and I started writing again.
And I suppose we should clarify that you really do compose with a pencil, is that correct?
I do. I was taught that way from a very young age. My teacher when I was young and taught me clarinet was named Morris Weinzweig. And his brother was John Weinzweig, who was considered the dean of Canadian contemporary music, very famous composer in Canada. And I guess he thought that the young clarinet student should learn to write music. And he taught me counterpoint and harmony. He had me writing out of a primer every week. So every week I was doing lessons with the pencil, and I just have continued working that way.
So what are the differences or maybe even the similarities between writing something like a film score versus maybe a concerto like you've been spending time on now?
I compare it to different brushes, that the film music is a wider brush, the concert music is a smaller brush, is more detailed that I can do in terms of the counterpoint, the harmony, the orchestration. And of course, the breaths are different. The phrasing is different. The ideas can be developed in a different way from concert to film. I enjoy both, and they're both equally challenging to me to write.
The three Lord of the Rings movies have become one of the most successful franchises in film history, and the scores are varied and eclectic, incorporating other artists, everybody from like Annie Lennox to Renee Fleming, James Galway, even a singing actor, Viggo Mortensen. So how did you envision or plan for all of these different elements coming together?
It was a kind of a step-by-step process of how we went from one culture to another. We started in the Mines of Moria, and Peter and I worked on that for several months. It's a 26-minute piece of the first film, Fellowship of the Ring. We took that to the Cannes Film Festival, so we recorded that in 2001. And then we worked our way forward into Lothlorien. And then we kind of backed up a bit and we went to Rivendell and we kind of worked step by step. We went through the world that Tolkien had created. And it was hard to really have a grand plan to it. Doug Adams spent 9 years in my archive and he wrote a book that shows the structure of the piece, which is there's over 100 themes and leitmotifs. But when I started, you didn't have that structure. It slowly developed over time. And I brought Tolkien's archive. And when you saw how he created the piece, it was very similar to how we followed our way. And it was almost like going through the caverns with a lantern ahead. It was dark. But, you know, the collaborators who worked on the film, the filmmakers, each supported each other so well that we just found our way through it, tried to create a piece that had as much hope and honesty and heart in it as we could give it.
Now, you've worked with several different directors like David Cronenberg and Martin Scorsese and others. What are the biggest differences in your collaborations with different directors? What do you like least and what do you like most?
Well, all these collaborations are different. They all have their own kind of dynamic to them. And of course, and as the film changes, even with the same director, like with David Cronenberg, the 15 films that we did, none of them are the exact same production. You kept progressing from one to the other. There was no way to look back. You were always looking forward. So it was a continually unfolding collaboration about how to use film to tell stories and what is film. You know, we're constantly questioning how to make films. Martin Scorsese is a brilliant, as we know, director, and is so musical and so versed in music, is so knowledgeable that it's a joy to work with him. And it's actually, I think the thing that connected us was the love of music. With Peter Jackson, I think there was this great drama to tell. And he, at the time that we worked on Lord of the Rings, I felt a real kinship with him as an equal collaborator on how to tell Tolkien's story. Because we had Tolkien's book to work with, everything focused on the book. And so we were equally trying to put the story up on the screen with as much truth as we could.
Do you have a particularly favorite moment in the trilogy that you always look forward to, and one that the next time we rewatch it, we might go, oh, that's Howard Shore's favorite spot in this trilogy?
I love the Mines of Moria. The whole piece of Moria is really a world in itself, because it has, there's a lot of relationships going on. I love the small moments, you know, with Frodo, with Gandalf, and there's just wonderful, beautiful moments. And of course, it also has great drama to it. The Bridge of Khazad-dûm and the fall of Gandalf and the loss of one of the members of the Fellowship. So it's really, it's like an encapsulation, really, of the whole beginning of the story. I found that when writing the music for Lord of the Rings, I connected, I think, to Tolkien's life and his story through nature, because I wondered how I made this connection to him. And I live in an oak wood in New York, and I've created a garden there with my wife Elizabeth, and we've worked on it for many, many years, 25, 30 years. And I've discovered that as the garden improved, the music kept improving. And there must have been something in the inspiration of the beauty of the forest and the garden that we created in it that really inspired my work.
And that's the extended podcast version of New Classical Tracks here on American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julie Amacher.